This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751. Or send in your question through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org.
Today, we have a very, very interesting episode. We have a caller by the name of Nigel, and he has some questions, and he wants to talk to Dr. Lyle on air, and we're thinking it might be the benefit to the benefit of the listeners using this type of the theories that we've been talking about the last few months, and to see if it has any practical applications and what that's all about. So we're going to welcome Nigel on the radio. Nigel, how are you doing today?
Doing well, thank you. It's a beautiful day here in Los Angeles. Just been down to the Santa Monica Pier. So, beautiful day.
Wonderful. Day. And Dr. Lyle, how are you doing today?
Great. Glad to be here.
Excellent. Good. So, I'm just going to let you guys take it away, and we'll listen in.
Okay, very good. Hey, Nigel, how are you doing?
Doing well, thanks, Dr. Lyle. As I said, a lovely Sunday evening. How about yourself?
Terrific. Yeah, I'm not down there by the beach, so I'm up in the San Francisco Bay Area. So you got a little better situation there.
I guess so. All right.
Yes. All right. Well, so I guess you've listened to the show a little bit and have some interest in this. And I guess I'd begin by just asking you sort of, you know, what some questions you have are, or what any challenges that you're dealing with that you'd be just sort of interested in talking about or maybe trying to get a little bit of assistance with?
Yeah, Nate and I have discussed various things in terms of dating, in terms of, and I understand you're an evolutionary psychologist. Is that the correct term?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and really, I've been sort of, for most of my life, I was sort of a serial monogamist. I always thought that there were two options open up to you. You either had deep, meaningful, monogamous sex, or you had casual, meaningless sex. And that didn't really appeal to me, so I always used to say, well, I must be a monogamous sort of guy. I didn't realize there were any other options. Now, from your position, do you feel like there is a spectrum, or do you think that generally speaking, human beings are one way or the other?
Oh, actually, human beings aren't one way or the other. Relationships are sort of one way or the other. So the any normal human being has within them the ability to be shifting their mating strategy. So a male that may be and yet even within that context, a given man may be more. Actually, most men are actually like you. So most men would prefer to have a monogamous relationship where it felt very deep and meaningful, where the person really cared about you and you care about them. So that is actually the worldwide preference inside of our species. However,
genetically,
yes, absolutely. So it's going to turn out though that there sits inside. It's kind of like, let's suppose you have a couple of different CD players in your car CD player. So you have one of them that is your favorite, but you have another one that you also like. Okay.
Gotcha.
And so it's going to turn out that I actually have a name for this, and I call it wife Chippy. Okay. So that a typical male would, if he's really into his wife, would just soon have sex with his wife three times and then have sex with somebody chippy little, hot little chippy on the side once. So if he could, you know, so that's sort of what's sitting inside the average male's psychology typically. And so both strategies reside inside of essentially all males. Now, some males are going to be more what we're going to call pair bond dominant. In other words, they're just more into pair bonding than they are into casual mating. And this could be all things being equal. I mean, it wouldn't depend upon their personal life circumstances. So you will find, I don't know the facts, but for example, you could have a guy like Sean Connery who could have easily played the field with three different females a day, but it really wasn't in him. Okay. In other words, apparently this was not Sean Connery's sexual psychology. He was pair bond dominant. On the other hand, you might have a la Magic Johnson, you know, that theoretically slept with 6,000 women over 10 years. That's someone who is casual mating strategy dominant. But Magic Johnson also was very attached to the woman he eventually married, named Cookie. And so, in other words, the monogamous pull is still in even a casual mating heavy male. But so each of us has within us those two strategies, and they tend to get played out depending upon circumstances. So,
there's a middle ground, because I'm of the belief that you should be able to have deep, meaningful sexual connections with more than one person at the same time. So is that a mating strategy or not?
Yeah, I don't think that's a strategy that flies. And let me tell you why.
Really?
I don't think so. I mean, there may be a few rare individuals out there that could sort of pull that strategy off. But let me tell you what you mean when you say deep, meaningful connection. Deep, meaningful connection to the female brain means that you are going to go all in with your resources, directing them at me and my offspring. Okay? That's what that means to the female. So, therefore, by definition, males cannot be having deep, meaningful relationships with multiple females, not if they're telling the truth.
Okay? Well, I mean, so, that discounts the whole notion of polygamy when it comes to, I mean, a lot of the reasons why we see having an alpha male and many females is because we like to see we've evolved from chimps or somewhat gorillas as well that have those sort of structures in place. Do you think we're closer to chimps, or do you think we're closer to bonobos?
We're actually eons away from both of them.
Right.
We're nowhere near either one of those species. So we are millions of years away from them. So we're more like the difference between dogs and cats. Okay? So you can't be thinking this is sort of physical anthropology 101, is that we've learned that this species is species is out incredibly unique. And if you want to try to understand the sexual psychology of our species, you have to examine a lot of different factors, okay? And so we are clearly a species where male provisioning of females and their offspring is a very, very big deal, okay? And so a male cannot, even in Stone Age environments, it is exceedingly difficult for males to be holding down two relationships at the same time. And so an alpha male with a lot of push, you know, can sort of pull that sort of thing off, and usually does for periods of time. But a typical male, in other words, out of 20 males, very few of them will ever pull off such a thing.
Well, I mean, let me ask you this. Could you not envision an environment where there were a number of males and a number of females, and all the resources that you're talking about were shared equally among the females, and all the sex was also shared equally among all the females? So an egalitarian tribe, so to speak, which I think maybe Nate may have mentioned Sex at Dawn to you before, which is a book I've read. And could we not have evolved from that? Do we have to evolve from these pair bonded units?
No, let me. You got a little confusion here. Okay, so the answer to your question about whether or not you could have this sort of egalitarian system, the answer is no. So there never was any sort of egalitarian system, and there is not an egalitarian system even in other animals. So what's going to happen is that through different mechanisms, animals exercise mating choice. And so it's going to turn out that in humans, the females and actually in all species, the females are generally extremely discriminating about which males they mate with. They're designed by nature to be this way because they hold very valuable reproductive resources, particularly eggs in a womb and the machinery to actually reproduce another entity. And so the female eggs are very valuable. And as a result, it would be anti-evolutionarily advantageous to squander those valuable resources indiscriminately. So females do not do that. So females actually are exquisitely discerning and discriminating about which males they mate with. So so right away we got a problem, because if there's 10 females around in a little egalitarian society where supposedly all the resources are being shared, and there's 10 males, trust me, the females have very strong preferences about which males they want to screw and which ones they don't want to screw.
How would they decide that if all the resources were split fairly? How would they decide which male to sleep with?
They would decide on physical characteristics and mental characteristics that were associated with low mutation loads. So the females are designed by nature to try to pick out differences in males in gene quality. So, for example, it turns out that if you look at males at different deciles of physical attractiveness just by photography, so you have a male that is truly a 1, and then another one that's a 2, and another one that's a 5, et cetera. If you actually then have those guys ejaculate into a jar, and then you observe their sperm motility, you will find that the handsomest men have the best sperm motility, and the least handsome men have the worst sperm motility. So even
at
the level
though,
of, what's that?
Your sperm motility changes as you grow older.
Yeah, I know. And
so that
your
being
looks.
The case, does that mean so
you're
does
uglier.
That mean sorry?
Yeah, you're uglier. The older you get, the uglier you get, and the females are picking that up. So the female's brain is actually designed by nature to actually calibrate your gene quality by looking at your appearance. Okay? And that's how we calibrate their gene quality, by looking at their appearance. So we're looking at all of their physical characteristics, and that's just getting started, because in our species, not only do we look at physical characteristics, which is typical in the animal kingdom of animals being unbelievably discriminating about the other animals' looks. Okay, so human beings share that characteristic with animals, that we are very, very discriminating about the looks of our potential mates. But not only that, there is no egalitarian communist wonderland anywhere in human nature. That
bonobos,
it turns out that what's that?
Bonobos.
No. No.
No,
this is the bonobos live in an interesting little mating situation that they particularly have. But remember, they have nothing to do with humans. They're not related.
Well, wait a second. But you have drawn parallels between humans and animals in
sure.
certain characteristics, but not in other characteristics.
Right. Because I'm just trying to explain to you that in our species, males provision females. Okay, this is actually a very typical process that you will see in any species where there's going to be what we call pair bonding. So it's going to turn out that in 97% of mammalian species, including bonobos, there's no pair bonding. So they don't have that characteristic. Okay.
Is there monogamy?
No. No, they don't. So they don't have a pair bonding system in that species. Okay. So in humans, and there are about 100 mammalian species that have a psychological characteristic that we're going to call pair bonding.
Okay, this is where males basically get themselves locked in on one female and extremely interested in her, and then when she gets impregnated, they stick around and provision offspring. Okay, that doesn't happen in the bonobos, and it doesn't happen in the chimps. So this is not characteristic of these relatively close relatives of humans. So the that sort of mating strategy is known even in fairly close species to literally a few genes can trip the difference between how a species winds up going about its business. So, for example, in one kind of a prairie vole, they are very promiscuous. That's a promiscuous mating strategy like the bonobo. But then in a very, very closely related species that you might have difficulty telling the difference between the two species, they behave completely differently. And the whole species is organized around a pair bonding strategy. So humans are heavily pair bond strategic. And so therefore the females are not just discriminating about the males about their looks, but they are also very discriminating towards the males about their ability to protect and provide resources. And so that's why there's never been some egalitarian system where the chicks didn't care about how well the boys could hunt. Okay. So in humans, the women are looking at the men, they're looking at their physical characteristics, they're trying to determine how many mistakes there are in their genetic code, and the least mistakes they have in the code, the handsomer the women find them. And that's why the women have high agreement as to who's attractive. That's why we're never going to have our little mating system where we've got 10 men and 10 women and everybody shares equally. Never going to happen. All the women are going to want to be mating with the guys that are the most attractive, and all of the guys are going to be wanting to mate with the women that are the most attractive. And so there's going to be tremendous conflict of interest in those individuals. And that's why humans don't do that.
Well, let me ask you this, then.
There
are certain other things that human beings don't naturally do. For example, I don't think we're naturally philanthropic. We're naturally,
yes, we are. Naturally. Yes, we are.
Yes, we are naturally philanthropic?
Yes. Huh. Yes, we are.
So if we are naturally philanthropic, why don't we want to share sex in the same way that we would share resources?
Because the reasons for that, well, you could in principle, but it wouldn't be the same process as when people share other resources. So when you share resources, there are reasons why people share resources, and one of the main reasons they share resources is to demonstrate their ability to waste the resources, and the reason why they are motivated to waste resources is to demonstrate that their gene quality is so much better than their competitors, that they have plenty of other resources for their own consumption, and that they literally are so outstanding at gaining resources that they can afford to waste them. Okay, so this is actually a sexual advertisement strategy in humans, and so that you wouldn't be sharing sexual resources. That isn't what you would be doing. And so that's not something that people do.
Right. And I suppose the way looking at this way, it kind of makes sex seem, rather unromantic and rather as though we're sort of a slave to the way that we're hardwired genetically, which, maybe that is the way that we are. But let me ask you this. Homosexuality has been prevalent throughout all of humankind, essentially, certainly
What's
since
that?
Written times. Homosexuality?
Homosexuality, yes.
Yeah, has been present within humans ever since written times.
Right.
But that doesn't seem to fit within any kind of traditional mating strategy, right? What do you think, from an evolutionary psychologist standpoint, is going on when people are homosexual?
Right. Actually, let me explain what happened. The homosexuality appears to be an anomaly with respect to understanding that the entire purpose of life is to reproduce genes. So essentially there was two possibilities in staring down this anomaly of homosexuality. There was essentially two possible roads that one could take to try to figure out why it exists. The first road, the first road would be that this is simply some kind of a mistake. Okay, so in essence, if you think about when animals mate, it's extremely sophisticated how they have to have the ability to recognize their own species, and then they have to recognize the opposite sex of the species, and they have to have a bunch of feelings and behavior associated with trying to procure a mate. And so they have what we're going to call mating search images, and those images are largely visual, but they can also be olfactory. They can also be tactile. In other words, they can also be auditory. In other words, certain animals make certain sounds that are very sexually attractive, and that winds up being how it is that mating is decided. That's going to be true in whales and certain frogs and birds and so on. So, but the question is, how would it be possible to have a homosexual animal be born? And the one answer would be, it's a mistake. There's a loose wire in a very complicated system, and once in a while, a wire gets loose, and that's just how it happens. Now, that happens all the time, by the way. There's all kinds of little mistakes all over the genetic code. So, you know, somebody's has some little part and parcel of their body or mind that doesn't work very well. Like, for example, Asperger's. Okay, so you have all kinds of little circuits that could go haywire, and possibly homosexuality was a little haywire circuit. Now, of course, that doesn't fly very well with the homosexual community, but science doesn't really care about anybody's feelings. They care about the truth. So that was one possibility. The other possibility was that homosexuality was actually some kind of adaptive mechanism. And so, for example, maybe it was true that, for example, men that were homosexual would be particularly helpful to their nieces and nephews. And maybe if they were so helpful to their nieces and nephews that maybe they essentially sacrificed their own mating life and then provisioned, you know, their sisters and brothers' offspring, and maybe that gave a statistical advantage. So maybe there was some essentially advantage biologically to this characteristic. Now, it turns out that the answer is sort of both. So we've now figured out the reason for homosexuality, and I'll explain it to you. So the enigma of homosexuality is that it could actually that it reduces the genetic success of the individual that happens to be homosexual. So the question is that of course, a third possibility that existed that we have dismissed was the idea that homosexuality could be the result of some bizarre developmental assault. Maybe you got felt up by Uncle Louie and you liked it so much that you became gay as a result of this. Okay, now that turns out to be utterly and completely untrue. So you cannot change people's sexuality by virtue of their experiences. So these are mating search images that are embedded into their nervous system at birth. Are actually in utero. Now, so here's the deal. So it turns out that one day an evolutionary psychologist stared at this problem and came up with a solution. And the solution is that if homosexuality is being caused by a genetic mutation that results in reduced gene success for the individual that is holding that gene, then somewhere else in the gene pool where he's related, it may be causing an increase in genetic success. So it turns out that the most likely way to increase reproductive success is to increase sexual attractiveness. So it turns out that following this logic, the very same kinds of genes that cause people to be homosexual are the same kind of genes that cause women to be effeminate. So homosexuality is the estrogenizing of the brain. And if the brain of a male is sufficiently estrogenized in utero, then the mating search image will tip over and they will wind up with effectively the female's mating search image, which is a male. So that male will wind up being attracted to males instead of attracted to females. And so it turns out that a gene that would cause a hyperloading of estrogen is a gene that would vary every once in a while tip a boy, a male child, into being a homosexual. Now, it turns out that if we then look in that gene pool and we find his sisters and we look at his sisters, we should see that his sisters are hyperestrogenized because they're carrying the same gene. And so we know that hyperestrogenized females are more sexually attractive than average females. So it should be the case, and if you're more sexually attractive, then you mate more advantageously with fancier mates and your children have better opportunities. So it's going to turn out that more attractive women wind up with more successful children. They wind up with more grandchildren on average. So the question was then, scientifically, if you were to look at 100 sisters of gay males, they should be more sexually attractive than the 100 sisters of straight males. And that turns out to be scientifically verified. Okay.
Oh, wow.
So that's how that works.
Wow. Fascinating.
Yes. So there you go. So I'm trying to think. I was thinking about circling back around. You had some other question that was still a little bit open. Oh, I think the question was, are we sort of slaves to the genetic code, or can we sort of break out of these things? And the answer is that we are slaves to the genetic code. So you're designed by nature to actually, like, whether or not you want to have children or not, You are designed with hardwired systems to, for example, if you're a male and you're heterosexual, you're designed by nature to be able to analyze the individual differences in females for their sexual attractiveness. So you cannot, like, hypnotize yourself out of that. So today, it would be a great benefit to human happiness if the males in the world could not care about the fact that women are fat. Okay, it would be tremendously valuable. And the reason is that people are eating such amount of rich food and with such sedentary lifestyles that the average female gains 40 pounds in fat between her 16th birthday and her 36th birthday. So the average 36-year-old female in the United States is 40 pounds overweight. Now, the problem with this is that the male is designed by nature to look at an expanded waistline and infer that the woman is pregnant. And if a woman is pregnant, it's not worth seeking her out as a sexual partner. So when men are designed by nature to find overly heavy women sexually uninteresting, we cannot hypnotize men out of this. They are hardwired by nature, and they will continue to wind up pursuing women who have a shape that indicates that they're fertile. So the same is true with female psychology looking at males. The female is going to look at males not only for their physical characteristics, but their psychological characteristics and in their willingness and toughness and aggressiveness and intelligence with respect to getting resources. And then they're also going to be wanting those males to signal to them that they are the particular special female for whom the male wants to signal and give all of his resources to. So the female seeks what we're going to call love from the male because she's designed by nature to be trying to reproduce her DNA in an environment of where she needs resources and therefore she needs protection and provision. And she was designed by nature to seek that out of a highly interested mate. So we cannot escape these strategies. We're stuck in these timeless card games is what's going on, Nigel.
So when a lot of people who, you know, a guy who's not necessarily considered attractive, he's going to still be attracted to the most attractive girls, right?
Yes, correct.
But then when he realizes, oh, I can't get one of those because I'm not attractive enough, and he gets to somebody that is of his attractiveness level, then
right.
Is there some kind of psychology going on where he has to convince himself that he's happy and he's content and he's settling? Or could he really truly feel that this woman is the most beautiful woman in the world?
Well, he wouldn't feel that it's the most beautiful woman in the world, but he could be what goes on here is the following. This is going to be what we're going to call calibration. So mercifully, our psychology is designed by nature to go through a process that we're going to call calibration. And it's critical for the organism to calibrate its relative competitive strengths and weaknesses so that it does not waste its life trying to search for something that it can't attain. So let me give you an example. So the average eighth grade boy in the United States, 85% of eighth grade boys believe that they're going to be professional athletes.
Right.
It turns out that 1 in 10,000 will become a professional athlete. Now, as they go through high school, a bunch of them are going to start to see the light. And so they will go through a process where they'll have some disappointing instances where they find out that there's no way this is going to happen. And this is going to get more and more brutal as you get all the way to number 9,998, who he is almost good enough to be a professional athlete. He's one little lucky breakaway, but he's not quite good enough. Okay, so he's a 1 in 5,000 athlete. He's not a 1 in 10,000 athlete. And so so there's going to be increasing sort of little heartbreaks along the way. But then what happens is, so the individual who is almost good enough to be a professional athlete, we can see that since he doesn't know that he's not quite good enough for a long time, he will continue to pursue and invest this in this process for many, many years because he believes that he's likely to get there. And in fact, he's so close that he can't tell, okay? And so, but one day he will finally, by his 26th birthday, he'll give up and he'll realize, it looks like I'm just not going to make it, okay? And now he'll start to figure out how to pursue his life's goals and dreams through some other mechanism. So this is exactly what happens in the mating game for humans. Now, none of these, like I believed that I was going to be a professional athlete when I was in the eighth grade. And yet it became increasingly obvious by the time I was a senior in high school that that wasn't going to happen, and therefore I didn't even really think about it very much, okay? So what happens is that the mind is designed by nature to try to utilize your time and energy, which is the two constraining resources that you have as a life form. That the mind is designed by nature to try to assist you in figuring out where you should be placing your resources. And so by 12th grade, I realized that my relative strengths was my intelligence, not my athleticism. Okay? And so as a result, and it also wasn't some stellar Hollywood looks. So I realized that my best move to distinguish myself from sexual competitors was going to be with the mind, not with the looks and not with the athleticism. And so as a result also, what's going to happen, so in that same way, people are constantly calibrating where they are. And so a guy who's a 5, of course he would love to be mated with and have a 10 that's in love with him. Okay? But the problem is that is not a possibility. And so as a result, it's not even possible that he's going to get a 9, okay? Now, the bandwidth of acceptance possibility is pretty wide. In other words, if he's Phil Collins, you know what I'm saying, he may wind up with a 10. But that's because he is a 1 in a million artist. And so some 10 somewhere may actually be able to choke down his looks and be very attracted to him. But most of the time, we're going to wind up with people within 20th percentile of our attractiveness. And so the male who is a 5 is very likely they're going to wind up with a 6. Now, he's designed by nature to be willingly sexually attractive to a 6 if that's the best he can get. Okay? And so nature doesn't say, well, hell, there's 10s out there that are far more reproductively valuable, you would have much fancier grandchildren who would be much more sexually successful than the children that you're going to have if you mate with this girl, okay? But the problem is there ain't any 10s that are willing to mate with them. So as a result, nature, again, like there's no professional athlete jobs for me graduating from high school, you take the avenues that you have available to you and you do the best you can. And that's how it works.
Interesting. Let me ask you this. I did biology when I was at university, and one of the things I was studying was hybrid vigor, which is where if you cross like a white rose with a red rose, the pink rose
yes.
is stronger than either of the angels. Now, does the same
yeah.
thing work with humans? So if someone of one race has a child with another race, is their kid, generally speaking, automatically going to be a better genetic code?
No. This is
no?
It's a misunderstanding, right? Yeah, this is a misunderstanding that the genetic differences in races are a big deal, and they're not. It's going to turn out that there's more, far more genetic diversity in a small little in a little town in Ireland than there is in the genetic diversity between races. So it's going to turn out that the problem of optimizing sexual recombination to try to get good offspring is going
yeah.
to take place not between races, but it's going to take place by sniffing people's smell. And it's going to be also observing little funny little characteristics about them and trying to put together an optimum blend. So, for example, females' olfactory system is very, very sensitive to male scent. And the reason that's true is that we give off evidence, chemical evidence of our the nature of our immune system and its natural chemistry. And so you're actually designed by nature to seek out people whose immune chemistry is very, very different from your own. And the reason for that is that you actually want your children to have a lot of different tools than you had, because you want them to be – there's a long biological story why this is true. I'm not going to, like, explain it in detail for you. But there's it can be explained in a book called The Red Queen by Matt Ridley. There's a deep, important biological reason immunologically why you want to be doing exactly what you just talked about with crossing of the roses. So you want to actually cross – you have to understand that people in the natural history had no access to people of different races. That was impossible.
Right.
Okay? So the so it's going to turn out that we're designed by nature to be attracted to people who have these subtle differences that were designed by nature to pick up that would make very, very good combinations. This is why people are generally this is a reason why you're very not attracted to your brothers and sisters, is because their smell actually indicates that they have very similar genes with respect to your immune complexes. And from the female standpoint, particularly, females' noses are actually twice as acute as males. They are much, much more sensitive to smell than males are. And the reason for this is because they need to make sure that they're not impregnated by somebody who has a histoimmune complex that is not a good match for their own. Okay? A male, if he impregnates a female and it turns out that the kid's a dud, oh well, okay, it's not nearly the investment for them. So males don't have that kind of sense of acuity towards the female smell. The females are very picky about the smell of their mates. And it's because literally it's a driving force of what we're going to call chemistry, because they're actually trying to pick a good immune combination.
So is there any variation in terms of people being attracted to people of their own race versus somebody else's race?
It's going to tend to be the case that people are going to be generally most attracted to their own race, but there are a tremendous amount of individual exceptions there. And
yeah.
we're not sure what drives that, but probably something that drives that is a personality characteristic that we're going to call openness to experience. So people have six major dimensions on which they are very, very where human personality varies dramatically. And one of them is openness to experience. So you can imagine that the evolutionary reasons for this are likely to be as follows. So suppose that you are a rabbit that lives in an area where the optimum distance that you should ever go from the rabbit hole would be 100 feet, okay? But suppose that you're as a rabbit, you have a little less anxiety than the average rabbit, so you go 110 feet, okay? Well, if you do that, all other things being equal, athleticism and luck, you're a little more likely to get eaten by predators than the guy that only goes 100 feet. So that the gene that would cause you to be a little more adventurous would be a little less likely to be in the gene pool. And then you could think about a rabbit that would go out 150 feet, he'd be less likely, and then a guy that would go 200 feet, he would be less likely. Meanwhile, the optimal distance to go for the food and mating search is 100 feet. So then think of a rabbit who's so anxious that he only goes 100 feet. So he doesn't find optimal mates and food, so he's not taking enough risk. Okay, so if you can imagine that these individual differences would fall in a beautiful bell curve. So if you looked at 1,000 rabbits and how far that they would go from the hole, you would find the mean would be 100 feet, and then there would be a bell curve based on that. So this is, I forget what your question. Oh, this is personality. So openness to experience is going to be this characteristic. And in humans, that characteristic beautifully falls on a bell curve, just as we would expect. And it's going to have to do with how adventurous people are. And therefore, you know, if you're adventurous, you sometimes are able to grab a hold of spectacular resources that your more careful comrades aren't going to get. So that gene will survive, but it will survive in lower probabilities. And so therefore, it's going to have less than the bell curve. So we're going to find, I believe, I would be very surprised if we didn't, that people that are attracted to mates of very different looking races are likely to be people that are more open to experience.
Hmm.
That's probably what's driving that.
All right.
Yeah.
Fascinating. Fascinating stuff.
Yes.
Up there.
Yes. There's a great deal more to learn, you know what I mean, about how all this works. But,
sure.
But thousands of little pieces of the puzzle have actually been put together already.
Right.
Yeah.
So, do you think that I need to find a life mate to be happy or not? Do you think that's the ultimate goal for us as human beings, now that we've obviously left evolution behind in that number of thousands, however many tens of thousands of years ago, right? Or do you think we can do it in a different way where we're not so sort of torn by our genetic hardwiring?
Yeah, you're going to seek all the values that are designed inside your genetic hardwiring. So you're not going to stop that. I can't remember. Oh yeah, you talked about the ultimate goal for people. There is no effectively ultimate goal for people in terms of their life satisfaction. They were simply designed by nature to do a whole bunch of different things that lead to genetic success, and those things tend to be very pleasant. So your happiness is going to be, at any given moment, it's going to be dictated by what the evidence from your environment is telling you about how well you're doing at these very basic, you know, fundamental biologically driven goals of life. So are you valued by the tribe? Are you found sexually attractive by people that you find sexually attractive? You know, are you healthy and fit? Is there plenty of food? Do you feel safe from predators? These are the things that cause humans to be happy. And so you could build a chart, what I call a taxonomy of happiness, and it's going to turn out that it's fairly finite, that there's going to be certain kinds of environmental cues and interchanges that are going to cause human happiness. Now, one of those mechanisms is going to be found sexually attractive and interpersonally totally attractive and extremely valuable by somebody that you find the same. So there's going to be a signaling of esteem between two people where they basically say, I've looked at a lot of other options. I've looked over the world pretty carefully. You are, I believe, an outstanding trade for me. Okay? And this is what love is. It's this feeling of this is an outstanding trade. This person is super valuable. The resources that they carry within them, mental and physical, are not going to be easy for me to replace and may not be replaceable. So then you have a response to this that we're going to call love. And this is probably the most exquisite feeling you know, that a person can have it would make sense. In other words, it's basically saying you just got a screaming genetic deal and we are going to reproduce the DNA, your DNA. You get to mold your DNA with that outstanding specimen forever, okay? And that any offspring that comes, in other words, you guys are making a timeless deal that is meant to go across biological time together. It's the most flattering possible interchange that a human being can ever have. Okay, now, so you would say, can you be happy without it? Of course you can, because the moods of happiness are, this is like saying, you know, root beer floats are my favorite food. Can I ever enjoy a meal if I don't have a root beer float? The answer is absolutely. Could I enjoy my gustatory life if I never had a root beer float? Of course I could. I could have great enjoyment. Could I enjoy it to the maximum that it is possible to enjoy it? No. I cannot. Okay? You cannot, because you have within you the capacity to have the greatest possible enjoyment from a root beer float. So therefore, if the root beer float is off the table, you are missing the experience that is possible to you. So in the same way that people can be very happy alone, but they are not as happy as they had the potential to be. So this is the it seems like the holy grail of human life is to find the outstanding partner that you want to go through this life with, and it's pretty damn close to the Holy Grail, okay? It's going to turn out that the scientific evidence tells us that that is the single most important factor in predicting somebody's happiness. You know, this is no shock, okay? Actually, it turns out that if you do a split half on people's age, you will find that people up to middle age, the most important thing that predicts their happiness is whether or not they're happy in a romantic relationship. Towards the end of their life, it turns out that the most important thing that predicts their happiness is their health. Okay? So this makes sense, because as you age, health starts to become very painful, okay, because people start to fall apart. And so they literally feel really bad physically very often. And so that winds up statistically, since so many people in the data pool are doing so much suffering behind their physical health, the people that are not suffering are substantially happier than the people that are not that are suffering. And so it drives that correlation coefficient. Okay, but that's sort of an anomaly that doesn't have anything to do with human evolution. We see the most important value in human evolution. We can see it right in the data, and the data is, have you found an outstanding partner that you feel like is a screaming deal for you that you're really happy about? The people that have are on average the happiest people in the world, and that's why all the music and all the stories are all directed towards that problem.
Right. Is it problematic within society that certainly nowadays it's tough to maintain that sort of a relationship?
Well, here's the problem. There's many problems with this, Nigel, but one of them is the following problem, that the sort of the human being was by no means designed to have these relationships go on for 10 years. So the chip, we are using a chip inside, the mechanism is probably built for more like 5 years. So it's essentially, that's not saying that if you have a relationship that's been going on for 15 years that you're lying to yourself. That's not true. But what I'm saying is that the mechanisms, the way they were built, the discriminating mechanisms that cause you to have the excitement and profound happiness that you found someone outstanding, that only results from a process of the finest discrimination. It's like, this is the really outstanding one that I got, and I'm really flattered, and I'm really happy. Now, you're not designed, really, to search your whole life and never find that and never have that experience. You're actually designed with an excitement chip in order to – essentially what it does is the following. What you do is you look over your shoulder at your last couple, 3 or 4 years, and you essentially sift through the options, the mating options that you had, And if you sit through those mating options and you can think, you think essentially about what kind of traits were available for you, and then you come upon someone who is significantly better than any of those traits, it's very like that. What you will now find is you'll have love circuits firing up. Okay? So the love mechanism is a mechanism of comparativeness with respect to quality. It's exactly why someone takes a spoonful of one dessert and a spoonful of the other dessert, and the other one they say, oh my God, I love this. No, the first one's okay, but I love this. We actually use the same word. Okay? So the word love is the word we use to signal to each other that we value something very, very highly. You know what I mean? I love this music. I love this. I love my dog. Okay? The words in love. Okay, what does that mean? That means that this mate is particularly outstanding. Okay? Now, you're designed by nature to get those feelings fired up when it looks like this is the best deal you've seen in a few years. Okay, that's how that's going to work. Now, the problem is that, so it's not designed to be able to plot all the vicissitudes of human life over the next 40 years. There's just no way. That's not how the mechanism was built. The mechanism was built to say, you should mate with this one. This is a hell of a good deal. Take it. Okay? And that could easily not be your best deal 5 years from now. And for various and sundry reasons, it's probably going to be your best deal a year from now, because your circumstances will not have changed and their circumstances will not have changed. It will probably be the best deal 2 or 3 years from now, but 6 or 7 years from now, very good chance circumstances have changed substantially. And it turns out that somewhere out there, there's a better deal and you've found it, or you've got evidence that you can get a better deal. So the that's why, you know, you're going to find that this species does not typically pair bond happily for 40 or 50 years. They just don't do it.
Wow.
It's not characteristic,
right.
Not characteristic of our species.
Yeah. And so if you were going to design some kind of sexual society, you'd design us to be serial monogamists for a short period of time.
Yes. You'd have renewable contracts. The you'd almost have people have to go in front of a panel every 5 years, and both of them would have to tell the panel privately that, yes, I really do want to continue. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
And the panel could say, well, you know, even if both of you say that you want to continue, you know, we could cover everybody's ass somehow. Yeah, I would actually try to think through how I would do this and how you would manage to, you know, pull this off. But the truth is if a systematic breakups were actually more common and what do you call it, not socially unacceptable, then you would actually have a happier human race, because people that are effectively get locked in by this modern bizarre phenomenon called marriage, you know, very often just can't get out because there's just too many little social strings keeping them there.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow. Fascinating. Like, this has been a very eye-opening experience for me. Thank you. Really.
My pleasure.
Do you have like any books or any literature that I can read? Something that sort of sums up a lot of this stuff?
Yeah. One of the great books in this field is called The Evolution of Desire. And it was written by the social psychologist David Buss, and B-U-S-S. And David Buss is probably the world's leading authority on human mating behavior. And so when you read this book, you will see the detail and the sophistication in human mating systems and human strategic, you know, decision making. And you'll see really why it is that you're not going to walk away from these instincts just because we all would think it would be cool.
Right.
Okay? It's like, no, this is, you're going to try to turn a watch into a TV set if you're going to try to do that. And this is not how it's going to work. So there could easily be ways to recognize the mess that we have and to potentially socially engineer our way out of it in the ways that I was just talking about. Like, in principle, you could do that, but you will never wind up with anything that's going to that system that I'm talking about is actually much more consistent with the natural history of the species.
Right.
So in principle, we could wind up with some social engineering that could get around that mess. We actually
yeah.
are. In other words, divorce now is much less problematic than it was 50 years ago. So,
right.
But you still see the basics, the basic outlines of the game remain the same.
Wow, okay. All right, wonderful. Well, I think we're getting up close on an hour now, so
good.
Yeah, I appreciate your time, Dr. Lowell. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Thanks for calling, Nigel. Great talking to you.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.